It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We may think we're living in the age of fake news and disinformation. It's easy to point fingers at the internet and modern technology for spreading bad information.
But author Daniel Lawrence says for thousands of years, people have tried to lie, persuade, and disinform others for their own benefit. And we can learn from this history of manipulation to deal with it now.
Daniel Lawrence is an associate professor of writing in the Department of Writing, Language, and Literature at UW-Superior. His new book is called Disinformed: The History of Humanity's Search for Truth. Daniel, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks so much for having me, Kate. Happy to be here.
You know, it is easy to feel like misinformation and disinformation is a newer problem and then that didn't happen in previous generations or even thousands of years ago. But can you tell us, is that really the case?
No, that's precisely why I wanted to write this book. We read a dialogue called Plato's Phaedrus in one of my classes, and this conversation kept coming up with my students like, hey, Socrates is talking about the exact sort of things that, you know, I'm hearing on the news about disinformation. And so you go back, that's a dialogue that's 2,400 years ago, and some of the key thinkers that were central to founding these disciplines that we still practice today, philosophy and logic and rhetoric, they were thinking about these issues of what do you do when you have someone who's a talented speaker, but they're completely devoid of ethics? And throughout history, we see numerous examples of this. The most extreme is probably Adolf Hitler. So this is precisely the kind of person that Socrates warns about in Plato's Phaedrus. In that dialogue, Socrates appears as a character written by Plato. But nonetheless, we have Socrates warning us about someone who's a talented orator, who has a sense of the art of rhetoric, the art of persuasion, but has not linked that art of rhetoric, that art of persuasion with philosophy, with a sense of ethics, with a sense of what's meaningful to humans and our values. And that's precisely what you get with a figure like Adolf Hitler. You go back further to the origins of writing. Our first named writer, Enheduanna, who was the daughter of King Sargon of Akkad. And primarily that it was the first human poetry, but they were in essence propaganda pieces to celebrate this consolidation of her father's empire. So we have like thousands of years of propaganda, disinformation, and misinformation.
But we're armed with these smartphones, right? I mean, we have the Google in our pocket and we carry it around with us in our lives. And you know, you identify the German philosopher Martin Heidegger as someone who's arguing and really urging us to question our relationship to technology and consider its effects on us. What were his concerns that could inform the relationship we have with the smartphone in our pocket?
Yeah, this is a wonderful essay by Martin Heidegger in 1954, The Question Concerning Technology. And he says, wait a minute, you know, technology does not just have instrumental effects. You ask most people, what does a hammer do? They'll say the purpose of the hammer is to hammer nails. But for Heidegger, the purpose of the hammer really is to build houses. And then suddenly you can build structures where people convene. And now you have like social, cultural, economic things going on. And so there are these kind of secondary, unseen, unforeseen, unpredictable effects of technology. Social media, ostensibly, you know, when Facebook was created, MySpace, even the
now you're really dating yourself.
I'm dating myself a bit. But when these first launched onto the scene, ostensibly their purpose was to connect people, right? But over the last 10, 15 years, what have they done? They've grown into the world's largest advertising platforms. I mean, there was a really important shift that occurred about 2016, 2017, where companies are spending more money on digital advertising than all forms of traditional advertising combined. So print, radio, television, there's now, and I mean, this effect has just amplified since then. companies, organizations, political parties are spending huge amounts of money to target individuals through direct digital advertising, and it's incredibly sophisticated. So that promise of the internet, and it's, you know, you rewind even further to the 90s, and it's like, wonderful, we're all going to have a web of interconnected information that's going to enlighten us. That was the hope. Well, we've kind of made some fatal errors, perhaps, in that regard, where we've turned these technologies into extraordinary advertising machines.
We're examining the history of disinformation and how to identify it today, what to do about it. Daniel Lawrence is with us, writing professor at UW-Superior, author of the new book, Disinformed: The History of Humanity's Search for Truth. Daniel, part of the problem is that it's been hard to pin down what is the truth. Very hard, for instance, if it exists, as you know, going back to philosophy. And you are arguing that there are multiple forms of the truth that all have limitations. How does the concept of truth muddy the waters and how we evaluate information and what is before us?
Yeah, this is a really difficult and important question. So there's so many ways to think of what is truth. And the kind of common academic concept is like, if some fact can be verified and replicated, you know, but then you have very specific context in which you need to replicate the finding, and then if you extrapolate even to a small degree, it's like the results are extremely varied. So you have this, you know, you have a kind of scientific objective truth, but then what about our everyday lives? You can't look up a peer-reviewed study when you're making a decision about what kind of automobile are you going to buy, right? There's no absolute scientifically perfect evidence that's going to suggest how you should vote in any particular upcoming election. You know, we also have this divide between the subjective and the objective. So we experience subjective truths that cannot be objectively verified. I can be experiencing an extraordinary amount of pain right now. And, you know, you can do some brain imaging. And of course, those technologies have gotten quite advanced. But ultimately, there's no way to get into the brain, into another person's subjective reality to verify the truths. So we do have these kind of muddy waters, as you say, about what constitutes a truth. We also have these ideas of the social construction of truth, which, you know, this can be quite dangerous too. If multiple groups or parties of people believe something to be true, then this makes it true. Well, you know, a lot of people seem to believe that the earth is flat. This is a problem, right? Ultimately, you know, in seeking the truth, and what I mean by this in the book is I never claim to know what the truth is, but I really want to encourage people to take it upon themselves to go down that painful journey of discovering what the truth is for themselves. We have this wonderful idea from Socrates, which is something like, you know, the truth can be quite painful, but nonetheless, you have to go after it anyway.
You referenced the study in the book, and I thought it was so interesting. 2021 study, UW La Crosse professor, communication professor, finding that, look, most people don't lie. So how do we grapple with that and reconcile that with the amount of bad information people are circulating?
Yeah, it seems like actually a very small percentage of people are responsible for disinformation and misinformation. There's something maybe optimistic about that. Now, on the other hand, it does seem like there's a biological origin to lying. So there are plenty of kind of ethological observational studies of chimpanzees that say they'll be wandering around with their troop and they notice that there's a source of food somewhere off the path, and they'll note it and turn their head and look at it, but then they'll turn their head back and follow along with the rest of the troop, and then they'll circle back around later and, you know, kind of selfishly treat themselves to whatever fruit is hanging on the tree without
I've
alerting
been here
any
all
of the
along.
members. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, could there be perhaps some kind of biological origin, or what determines, you know, I can't venture into the neuroscience too much, being it's outside my field of expertise, but it seems like that study indicates that it's a small percentage of individuals who are actually contributing to these problems. And of course, then their voices can be amplified so significantly using social media technologies.
Mm. You argue that we need to be better rhetorical thinkers, rhetorical decision makers. How do we build that skill set?
Yeah, it's a great question. There are some heuristics that are really still useful that our ancient Greek thinkers developed. Aristotle, for example, has this classic triangle model. So it's ethos, pathos, and logos. And we kind of simplify and reduce it. If you look at any advertisement, any political messaging, any kind of inbound messaging, you know, you might receive like 1,000 different advertisements in a day across your Google search results, from your social media, listening to the radio, wherever this information is coming from. If you stop and you ask, what is the intent of the speaker or the originator of that message? Who is the intended audience? How have I been targeted by this information? And then how is the message constructed? So ethos, pathos, logos looks at, hey, ethos is the dimension of credibility. Is this person an expert on the topic on which they are speaking? Do you know them to be a trustworthy individual? For Aristotle, this was a really useful gauge of, it's essentially just trustworthiness, right? Mm-hmm. The character of the person. Have they demonstrated themselves to be a trustworthy individual? You know, that's a good measure of evaluating a truth claim, or at least beginning the kind of investigation into how much truth there might be in some particular claim. You can look at pathos, which is the dimension of emotion. How is some message trying to play with your emotion, those deep ancient brain centers that go back hundreds of millions of years? A lot of political messaging is based on fear or based on anger, trying to rile you up to get you to believe a certain thing or think a certain way. You can also look at the logos of a particular claim, a particular message, and think about, well, you know, is this a logically constructed argument? Are they committing some kind of logical fallacy? So even from, you know, from this ancient art of rhetoric, this art of persuasion, there's some really useful heuristics for just helping you to stop and break down all of this influx, all of these inbound messages, and to really think about things like who created this message, for what purpose, to what kind of audience, what are they trying to gain, what are they trying to get you to think or buy or do, and then what is the actual construction of the message itself. And I think that's something you can learn to do, to analyze and break down messaging, to understand how it's constructed and how it's attempting to persuade you to do something.
But you really have to take that time to slow down, to think it through, to put your attention away from something else, to really digest it. I want to ask you about the power of language and the power of storytelling, because you describe being in Grant Park in 2008, when former President Obama is first elected president, and the energy and what you were hearing and feeling around you. And I wonder if that experience, how it informs how we go about our world and what we think of a powerful speech, and the speech that is the way we talk and the way we tell stories and how we listen to people. What you learn from that moment?
Yeah, this is a beautiful question. I really like this. It's something about kairos. So this is an idea from the ancient Greek philosopher Gorgias. Kairos for the ancient Greeks is different from chronos. So we have two concepts of time. Kairos is the idea of opportune time. So something's kind of bubbling up. I mean, we see this in like the Arab Spring. We see it in social movements like the Black Lives Matter movement. We see this kind of confluence of things happening all at once that allow for new realities to emerge in, say, the political, social, economic landscape. You know, this is not, this is debated about whether, how can you institute something like this? Can you be an agent or a cause of change? Or is this kind of material reality just convalescing and coming together and making this happen? I tend to think that individuals are active participants in the world that we're creating. And so you can actually influence the sort of kairos of the moment. You can take a measure of what's happening in the world and become an active participant in these types of changes. Kairos is an incredibly important idea if you want to, I mean, even in marketing applications, it's like, what's the pulse of the world right now? What are people thinking about? What are people doing? Now, to speak more broadly about the stories and narrative and language, it's a great mystery. You go back maybe 70,000 years ago, and you have something that's we still don't understand anthropologically, archaeologically. It's this cognitive revolution. All of a sudden, you know, if you imagine you were on the moon observing human evolution for millions of years, all of a sudden these apes start telling stories and making bone flutes and playing music and participating in ritualistic behavior and writing images on the walls of their homes. It's something that happened that we don't particularly understand. You know, someone like Daniel Dennett would probably say, well, this is the result of some Darwinian process. And that seems like a pretty likely explanation. But nonetheless, we don't understand precisely what caused this cognitive evolution. But it's what makes us precisely human, it seems, is that our ability to use symbol systems to tell stories. And so this can be used to great measure. We've invented extraordinary technologies that have helped us in a number of areas. We've also developed extraordinary technologies in terms of their potential to completely wipe out our species. Nonetheless, these stories that we tell are incredibly powerful. They can lead us down. They can lead us toward various potential outcomes. In some ways, you know, they are a form of technology. Right? The very stories that we tell are technologies that we utilize.
Daniel, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Daniel Lawrence is an associate professor of writing, language, and literature at UW-Superior. His new book, it is called Disinformed: The History of Humanity's Search for Truth.